members, call the meeting to order of the Legacy Funding Division for February 14th. I hope you're all having a good Valentine's Day, or if you aren't, it will get better as we go along.
Why are you looking at me?
There are all kinds of things I could say, but I'm not going to. We actually do have a quorum present, and so I'd like to have the minutes of the February 8th meeting. Would someone move the approval of those minutes?
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the February 8th minutes.
Thank you, Representative Parkinson. Is there a second? I don't know. I don't need it. I'm just getting the swing of things. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes have passed. We will now proceed to House File 2086, Representative McNamara's bill. And I'll just preface a little bit today. What we'll be doing is going over this, and we said no amendments today. I should have given the instructions except for the A1 amendment, because the A1 amendment is essentially what becomes the bill. So the A1 amendment is a short one. It's being passed out now. And if there is no objections from anyone, we will allow the A1 amendment today. And then we will discuss this bill. Representative McNamara will go over it. And tomorrow we will take amendments on the bill and then take a vote on the bill. So, any objection to allowing the A1 amendment? Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the opportunity. Mr. Chair, if I could, I'd like to move House File 2087 for approval and be moved to the House Energy and Natural Resources Committee. And Mr. Chair, if Ms. Taylor could explain the A1, and then I don't have any problem. We can take it up tomorrow if anybody at the table would prefer to not take it up till tomorrow. But if Ms. Taylor could explain the amendment, and then if it's non-controversial, which I think it is, we could adopt it now, or we can wait till tomorrow. And I don't have any problem, whatever we do.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. I believe, if I heard properly, you just moved 2087, and the bill is 2086.
Mr. Chair, I did do that, and I've been known to transpose numbers. They have some name for that now. I can't remember what it is, but I do that every now and then, whether it's a phone number or a bill. And I looked at it. It's 2086. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We wouldn't want to pass 2087, and it would be a whole different bill.
I don't even know what 2087 is.
Did someone have their hand up? Anyone? So, yes.
Mr. Chair, I have a confession to make. I'm so sorry. But when the directive came out yesterday about that the amendments had until the COB, I had no idea what that was. And so we had that.
What?
But I heard
I didn't either.
It's close of business.
I thought it would have been something to do with a cornfield.
I had to ask. It was only the third person that knew what COB was. So acronyms aren't so are used very plentifully, but some of us don't know what they mean.
Well, thank you, Representative Murphy. That's a point well taken, and
So it's 5 o'clock today, right?
Yes. So point well taken. We'll work on acronyms. Thank you. All
us,
right.
Work on teaching us the new language.
Mr. Knutson, perhaps a list on acronyms. All right. Okay. With that, yes, Representative Wagenius.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to object to this going in, but I just want to clarify on line 1.12, it is your proposal that each of these lands that is being acquired has hunting and fishing on it and you're doing that statutorily as required by the Constitution.
Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wagenius, that would be conditioned on local ordinances and other local restrictions that could take place, and I believe that's more in line with how it is done. There is some changes in this amendment that deal with some of the hunting issues if we'd want. And Mr. Chair, maybe if it's all right with everybody, we could just wait and do this amendment tomorrow, seeing how there's some confusion of whether it's today or tomorrow. The bill's going to still be here tomorrow. We could have Ms. Taylor explain this amendment so members know, because specifically it does deal, I think, with some of the hunting clarification, and then she could explain what the one money item is.
All right, Representative McNamara, we could do it that way. We will explain the bill today. You can explain, Ms. Taylor, the amendment today, and we will just deal with it all tomorrow. Okay? You want, Representative McNamara, shall we start with Ms. Taylor? Or how do you want to do it?
I'm amenable today, Mr. It's the afternoon. I'm a morning person, so in the afternoon, I'm kind of like whatever. So
okay, yeah,
it would be good if Ms. Taylor, and if someone else wants to move the A1 and they feel it's okay, I just, that doesn't matter to me. Okay. I'm cool.
All right. The bill, unamended, has been moved, and we'll proceed with the discussion from there. Representative McNamara, why don't you start out whenever you want, Ms. Taylor, to.
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you. And this is the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Bill. I have two gentlemen here with me, Mr. James Cox, who's the Vice Chair of the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council and is a citizen member, and Mr. Bill Becker, who's the Director of the Lessard Sam's Council. So if they could both introduce themselves, say a little bit about the bill, and then Ms. Taylor could explain the A1.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Cox and Mr. Becker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, my name is Jim Cox. I'm the Vice Chair for the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council. I want to thank you for inviting us here today to bring forward our 2012 recommendations. I'd also like to thank all the organizations that participated in bringing projects forward to us this year. We appreciate all the hard work that goes into these projects. We also like to thank the state agencies that participate in our process, especially the DNR and Bowser, who not only bring projects forward but help us implement these projects once they're passed. With the help of our staff, our excellent staff, I should say, we believe the council this year brings forward another strong group of recommendations. In my opinion, these recommendations will meet the expectations of the people of Minnesota who supported the legacy amendment. Once again, prairies and wetlands dominate the habitat types receiving recommendations. However, I believe our signature project for this year comes from the forest region, the Mississippi Northwoods Project. This project is 2,000 acres, 3 miles of undeveloped shoreline along the Mississippi River, 60 acres of, it includes 60 acres of wetlands and a cold water stream just north of Brainerd, Minnesota. In our list of recommendations this year, I'm sure that you'll recognize many familiar names and programs. In our effort to continue to support successful and transparent programs, like the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge, Cass County Key Forest Habitat Project, RIM WRP, and Metro Big Rivers projects are all projects I'm sure you've seen before. We also have some new additions this year, like the Minnesota Moose Habitat Collaboration and the Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society. The council has also been listening to some of the constructive criticism that has been sent our way. We want to make sure that everyone understands we're listening to this and trying to act on it. This year, one of the things we've always heard about is, are we taking care of what we have? So I would like the committee to take note that this year we fully funded the DNR Prairie Grassland Habitat Restoration and Enhancement Project, which is basically a project that does restoration on enhancement already on lands already owned by the state. I'd also like to bring attention to that our largest acquisition this year will be a county forest and will carry no PILT obligation to the state. And finally, I'd like to talk about the $5.5 million appropriation for AIS deterrence. I believe this is the project the council is most apprehensive about, and for a number of reasons. Certainly, the council understands the enormity and the complexity of the AIS problem we face. We can also appreciate the tough choices that the legislature and the DNR are going to have to make in fighting these invasive species. We also understand the fact that none of us are going to probably be satisfied with the results or the decisions that are made. I think the council does believe we have a role to play in this invasive species fight. I'm not sure we're comfortable with just what that role is yet. Is it paying for barriers and deterrence? Is it to help implement the strategies that Professor Sorensen and his team finally developed? Or is it to provide healthy habitat for native game and fish populations that experts tell us could be one of the most effective deterrents? In the final analysis, I hope we take Professor Sorensen's advice and do not panic. In this time of scarce resources, we want to make sure we are prudent and careful how we approach this problem and make sure hysteria doesn't overtake common sense and critical thinking. With that, we appropriated $5.5 million for AIS, and I want to make sure everyone understands that we have no specific project. It's basically for deterrence. There's really no specific outcomes, nor is there no specific timetable. It's basically a blank check for aquatic invasive species.
Mr. Cox, who is the blank check to?
going to be to the Department of Natural Resources.
The DNR. So they decide then how that's going to be used for invasive species.
Right.
All right.
And finally, I would like this committee to understand that in making this appropriation, we've dropped our cash reserves below those recommended by the OMB significantly. So with that, I'll end my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Mr. Becker?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Bill Becker. I'm the Executive Director of the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council. I want to draw your attention to two handouts that are in your packet. This is the fourth recommendation. We've got enough history now that we're beginning to be able to take a look at the history of the use of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. I'll go over that in a moment. Plus, there is a map of the current projects in your packet. The bill you have before you is the result of a prolonged and detailed process of soliciting requests for use of the fund and hearing each project. In addition, in the area of AIS, we for the first time had aquatic invasive species in our call for requests, or RFP. We didn't get anything with dealing with the primary problem of silver carp. So when the DNA evidence was announced, the council heard a special request from the Department of Natural Resources and eventually heard it again. And that's where the $5.5 million comes from. The handout before you called At a Glance, looks like this, is a chronicle of the last three appropriations. Table one covers the appropriation amounts by Minnesota session year. We've appropriated $331 million if this recommendation is appropriated to 99 requests, and the Conservation Partners Program has entered into 131 grants per partners, with more to come with the existing funds out there. Table 2 shows the total acres impacted by activity type. We've protected in fee 35,800 acres, easement 261,000 acres. Are the restoration acres are 14,330, and as of this recommendation, if it's enacted, we will have enhanced 203,270 acres. All of this is according to the accomplishment plans that recipients are required to complete, and they indicate how many acres of property in Minnesota they will restore, enhance, those sorts of things. On page 2, you can see in table 3 the types of recipients. 45 non-governmental organizations have received funding, 16 local and regional governmental entities, 1 federal entity, the state government, 37 appropriations have gone to state government, and for a total of 99 programs funded. The total acres impacted by planning region, and these planning regions were mandated in the laws of 2009. So we don't have data for the appropriations of 2009, but table 4 shows the regions of the impact, and the metro region has 11,000 acres of impact. The forest prairie region has 68,000 acres of impact. The southeast forest region has 5,000 acres of impact. The prairie region almost 150. In the northern forest, 55,000. There are other measures of interest too, such as shoreline miles affected, the number of counties impacted, and the leverage dollars per leverage per $1 in OHF fund. The average is a little over 50 cents per dollar of OHF fund. On page 3 is a table that deals with payment in lieu of taxes and shows on the second to the last line, the annual PILT liability contributed by each session law appropriation and the cumulative annual PILT liability. As of the adoption of this recommendation, if it's adopted as is, we will have added to the annual cumulative PILT liability $578,000. You can see that most of the money's gone to the prairies, with the forest being second. On page 4 is a synopsis of the Conservation Partners Legacy Grant Program. As most of you know, Minnesota Statutes 97A.056 Subdivision 3 requires the council to recommend a Conservation Partners Grants Program. We recommended approximately $4 to $5 million per year. This particular package has a $4.9 million recommendation in it. These are grants between $5,000 and $400,000. We've developed a simplified application form for grants under $25,000, and you can see an idea of the recipients and the way the program has been working thus far. We've been referring to the LSOHC sections on page 5 as a map of those sections. These are based on the Department of Natural Resources ecological analysis of the state of Minnesota. And then on page 6, the last page, the back of the handout, you can see a partners list. At the top of the page are Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriation recipients. These are people that have gotten recipients of appropriations made directly by the legislature or through the Department of Natural Resources for an agreement with. Halfway down the page, you can see the list of the conservation program participants, starting with cities, counties, soil and water conservation districts, and nonprofit organizations. I've also been informed that you have received staff's annotated version of the bill, which looks like this. This is for your convenience. On the left-hand side is the appropriation bill language. On the right-hand column is staff's analysis of the appropriation. So you can see budget, personnel, the property that's going to be restored, protected, that sort of thing. I'm not going to go through this in detail, but you may want to keep it at hand as we go through the bill itself. Finally, the map of the recommended projects locations. You can see that projects are distributed throughout the state. This map is the data from all but six of the 30 appropriations in the package, six of the appropriations do not have specific sites as of this particular point in time. For example, REM WRP runs a competition later after the appropriations bill is signed and selects the project sites. This map is on our website. Each dot is electronically connected to the description of the project itself. So, with that, I will stand for questions or pause, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. One question, and if I went through this in detail, I probably could find it out for myself, but of the money appropriated last summer, how much of that has been designated or spent?
Mr. Chair, I don't have an exact figure on that. We know that the laws of Minnesota of 2009 is 97% expended according to our status report. There was a turnback of $1,580,000 by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service because of some legal problems, and $300,000 by the Department of Natural Resources because of a mix-up in administration of a program, I would best characterize it. People are working on 2010 and 2011 as we speak. These appropriations are available for 3 to 5 years, so they don't liquidate quite as quickly as the regular appropriation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Becker. And in terms of job creation, do you have any recent figures on how many jobs are created through these programs?
We actually do an economic analysis of the bill, and the first round of job creation creates 400 and some odd jobs. We'll get the committee the economic analysis directly in the bill in terms of jobs in the state agencies and in the NGOs. My recollection is it's of roughly 75, 50 in state agencies, 25 in NGOs. We'll get you those exact figures, too.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Becker. Representative Guineas.
Yes, thank you. Just a question on your chart that you've handed out to us. On page 2 in the middle chart, you have prairie. You don't have grasslands. Does this word prairie include grasslands, or is it all actual prairie?
It includes grasslands. We use the constitutional term prairie in all of our accounting.
Well, I think that might be a little misleading for Minnesotans, because we also have the language habitat for fish, game, and wildlife, and I always thought of the grasslands as habitat for game and wildlife. So I wouldn't want Minnesotans to think that we are doing something that we are not doing. So it would be helpful to have this prairie and grassland broken out. Which is actual prairie, because it's rare. We don't want to mislead them and think that, oh, no, prairie is not rare anymore. So people know the difference between prairie and habitat for game and wildlife.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
We'll break that out.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
I was given the numbers on the state and NGO jobs. I was a little off. It's 36.6 state jobs and 21.4 non-governmental organization jobs.
Thank you. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if Ms. Taylor could explain the A1 now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the A1, I'll just go through it. And what it does, in essence, is it takes all the recommendations that the Lessard Council put forward after the bill was sent to the legislature for the January 15th deadline. All the numbers changes. This is a reflection of an additional $2.5 million that the council recommended be added to the aquatic invasive species appropriation. On line 1.3, the term state has changed to paved, and this is in regard to the Mississippi Northwoods project. There's anticipated that a trail is going through, and the council would like sign off on any, it used to be state trail, this would be any paved trail now that it's going to be in county ownership. 1.4 is a technical correction. The numbers 1.8, this is just providing a little bit more clarity on what the aquatic invasive species appropriation would be, and it'd be to provide a structural deterrent. And this is sort of getting at the barriers that are currently being talked about. Lines 1.9 through 1.14 come about. The DNR had recommended as part of a ongoing conversation that also is about Section 10 too, about how to deal with how to make sure that lands are open for public taking of game and fish. And the 1.9 through 1.14 would require accomplishment plans to have a hunting and fishing management plan, and also a status of this plan to be included in the real property interest report that already is being reported to the council. In Section 10, what this would do is sort of codify, and it establishes and sort of clarifies how lands should be treated as far as the requirement to be open for public hunting and fishing. Paragraph A, this would applies to all state lands, and it just states that lands need to be that are owned by the state would need to be open for public hunting and fishing unless otherwise provided by state law. Paragraph B, this would apply to U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lands, and they would need to be opened according to the National Wildlife Refuge System Improvement Act. And then paragraph C is sort of the catch-all for anything else that's not covered by paragraphs A and B, and currently there really isn't a mechanism to close these lands, and so this would sort of give it that mechanism, and that would give, if you turn over to the other page, second page, the Commissioner of Natural Resources would make this determination similar to what they have authority to do for state lands. And this is consistent with what they've done in the past for specific appropriations. And just to point out on line 2.3, this is retroactive back to the first appropriation, so it's sort of consistent for all Outdoor Heritage Fund appropriations.
Thank you. Questions of Ms. Taylor? Or Representative McNamara, or anyone. Further questions? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, Mr. Becker, where can I find the expected outcomes for each appropriation?
Chair at all?
Mr. Becker.
Representative Murphy, you can find the outputs in the annotated bill itself. We are coming along on outcomes. Those can be found in the accomplishment plan. We did not include them in the annotated bill because they aren't up to quality, the quality that we'd like to see. That is the logic in going from outputs to outcomes. Hasn't been worked through well. We're working with project managers to get them to better describe outcomes.
President Murphy?
The accomplishment plans, Mr. Becker?
Yes.
Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, each appropriation has accompanying an accomplishment plan, which is a 5 to 15 page document that says what they're going to do. And we added the ability to enter in outcomes as well as outputs in terms of acres of prairie and acres of forest and things like that that are restored and enhanced to get to the more global outcomes of strengthen ecosystems and things of that sort. It's just taking a little bit of work to work the recipients through that process.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Becker, do you expect in the next round we'll have them accomplished? Or two more rounds? Or?
My outcome specialist nods yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy, are you done? Any other questions or comments? Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If at this time, if we're ready, I'd like Mr. Becker to walk through the bill item by item, if he could, and maybe if he could get, I don't know, Mr. Chair, it's up to you if you want to stop that each project or if you want him to get through the end and then take questions on the individual projects, whatever is your choice.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Members, which way would you prefer? Do you want questions after each section, or do you want to wait? Any preference? I think maybe pause after each section, and if there are questions, we'll take them then. It's fresher in people's minds, might work better. Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to begin on line 119 with the total appropriation. If the A1 amended is adopted and the Cartberry money is included, the total appropriation is $99,920,000, which leaves a fund balance of $2,428,000 that Representative McNamara referred to earlier. The remainder of the appropriations are divided into constitutional categories of prairie, forest, wetlands, and habitat for fish, game, and wildlife. And on line 1.24, subdivision 2, prairies, you can see that we're recommending $24,640,000 be appropriated to prairies. On the top of page 2, on line 2.1, is the first appropriation, Minnesota Buffers for Wildlife and Water Quality, phase 2. This is one of a number of phased appropriations that reflects the council's attempt to find programs that are congruent with the goals of the Outdoor Heritage Fund and appropriate to them year after year after year and keep feeding the money into them so that they get the impact that we're looking for after 25 years. $2,090,000 is to the Board of Water and Soil Resources. This is to expand clean water buffers and fund riparian wildlife buffers on private land. It expands 100-foot buffers to 200-foot buffers on either side of the stream. On line 2.13, I want to point out there's an authorization to deposit $90,000 in a monitoring and enforcement fund. The statute governing this easement stewardship account is in the bill on page 21, section 8, and we'll get to that later. The next appropriation begins on line 2.22, Minnesota Prairie Recovery Project, phase 3. Meaning it's the third appropriation of this particular program. $4,610,000 is for an agreement with the Nature Conservancy to acquire native prairie in savanna and restore and enhance grasslands in savanna. On page 3.
Mr. Chair.
We are going to take questions as we go. On this one, I have two questions. On line 2.31, you have the line that says annual income statements and balance sheets for income. I didn't see that in any other of these appropriations. Where's this income coming from, and tell us about it?
Mr. Chair,
Becker?
Representative Wagenius, these lands are held by the Nature Conservancy and are used in a working lands manner for grazing and things of that sort. To emulate fire and natural disturbance of the prairie. That's the income. The income itself is used to pay the payment in lieu on the lands, or the taxes, excuse me, the taxes.
Roseanne Wagenius.
So this is all easements then?
Mr. Chair, it can be easements or fee simple.
I'm trying to remember if we have to pay, do they pay taxes on fee, land they hold in fee, if it's a nonprofit that's conservation land?
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is actually a novel idea and a pretty neat project, Representative Wagenius, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm not sure if the Nature Conservancy is in the audience or not, but they actually are voluntarily committing to make these payments, if I remember correctly. It's kind of a unique idea here, and that's the idea behind it. They are an NGO and are not obligated to do that, but I believe they're committing on the title for it in perpetuity and making arrangements to make those payments. They're more looking at it a model like we've explained.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So all of the annual income will be going to this payment in lieu of taxes.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wagenius, I don't think I can say that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
All of the income will be going into the management of the lands purchased, including payment of the taxes.
So then I think we have to ask, I hear about the taxes, the management of the land, what does that include? What they're making a profit off this. This is different. They're making a profit off the land, and then we are saying they, instead of returning the profit to the Heritage Fund, they are using it to do what, and how do you monitor that?
Mr. Beck.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius. It's used to set up the grazing, to define the paddocks that are going to be grazed or the parcels of land that are going to be grazed intensively. So it goes for fencing and things of that sort. It goes for personnel that are necessary to negotiate the use of the lands. There is no guarantee that there's a profit. There's the supposition that there's going to be income. We monitor it through the annual reports, plus the agreement put together by the Department of Natural Resources to govern this appropriation that addresses income and ensures that income will be plowed back into the in purposes of the appropriation.
Representative Wagenius.
So part of this is to buy fencing. So the part of the appropriation is to buy fencing. That seems like a new. So are we assuming here that it's cheaper to graze than to burn as a management tool? I mean, I don't understand. Fire is a better management tool. So what's the thinking here?
Ms. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, that it's part of the toolbox. Fire goes along with it.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be a good idea as we go through this. We are going to be back here again tomorrow, and we can be here longer. This is a really important bill. It's $97 million of spending of state resources. And I think it would be a good idea. Nature Conservancy did spend some time in front of Lessard Sams explaining the project. It is a novel idea. Grazing is something going forward in our prairies that does offer a good tool, potentially would allow for, there's been a lot of discussion about PILT and the non-payment of PILT and such. This was an NGO stepping forward to say they would voluntarily be willing to pay the taxes, and one of the ways it's able to do is by grazing. There's some income potential in grazing. Burning actually costs money to do. So that was the idea. I think it would be appropriate, Mr. Chair. I looked. I don't think they're here today. I don't know all their people, but we could have them come represent Wagenius tomorrow. I think it would be a really good idea. I was impressed with the idea, and I think it may be beneficial. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Good idea. I trust no one from Nature Conservancy is here.
I'm with the Nature Conservancy, but I don't know the specifics of the project to speak to them, but I can certainly pass along the message to invite somebody to listen to here tomorrow.
Appreciate that. Would you convey to the Nature Conservancy that we would like them to be here tomorrow?
Absolutely.
Before I get to Representative Dill here, I just have one question. If recipients of funding from this fund do make a profit, is there a standard for what they do with it?
Mr. Chair, yes, there is. The contract that they signed with the state has them agree to plow it back into the purposes of the same purposes as the appropriation. Okay. This is just the accounting form.
Okay, thank you. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara. I get the idea that the Nature Conservancy has agreed or apparently agreed to voluntarily pay the PILT or in lieu of the PILT, but has the local unit of government where these lands are located bought into that, knowing that there's risk that promising to pay and paying are maybe two different things?
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Dill. I feel better if Nature Conservancy answers it tomorrow, but my understanding is they're going to have the land treated as taxable, and it was my understanding that's an ongoing thing in a legal document that they're reaching in agreement with, that it's not something they can decide in the future to quit doing, and it would be better for them to explain it.
Continue, Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, on page 3, line 3.1, is the Cannon River Headwaters Habitat Complex, phase 2. This is $1,760,000 for an agreement with the Trust for Public Land to acquire and restore lands in the Cannon River watershed. They would be managed as wildlife management areas or aquatic management areas. On line 3.15, wildlife management area acquisition. This is $2.9 million to the Commissioner of Natural Resources to acquire land and fee for wildlife management areas. Line 3.23, Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge Land Acquisition Phase 4. This is $1,580,000 for an agreement with the Nature Conservancy in cooperation with the United States Fish and Wildlife Service to acquire land and fee for permanent conservation easements within the Northern Tallgrass Prairie Habitat Preservation Area in western Minnesota for addition to the Northern Tallgrass Prairie National Wildlife Refuge. Fee acquisitions, some is easement, some is fee. Fee acquisitions will be a part of the Waterfowl Production Area Program.
Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to ask Mr. Becker, when he addresses each of these and they say PILT zero and they have something to do with a nonprofit, what's going to happen? Just like my last question that I asked Representative McNamara, because I think this one says, am I on the right one here? I keep flipping the PILT zero. But yet it talks about fee acquisition by the Nature Conservancy in cooperation with the Fish and Wildlife Service. So, can you understand my general question?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do. Representative Dill, yes, I do. And let me just, to your question, say that when it says PILT zero, that's state-paid PILT is zero. The federal government will pay their form of PILT on these lands that are acquired and transferred to them. And they have a dual system of payment. One is federal revenue sharing, and the other is payment in lieu. And I've got information on that if you want it. And I'll try to remember to mention it next time I see it. Yeah. On page 4, line 4.4, accelerating the wildlife management area program, phase 4. This is $3.3 million to for an agreement with Pheasants Forever to acquire land and fee for wildlife management area purposes. So this is the NGO match program to the department's wildlife management area acquisition program. Line 4.14 is the Green Corridor Legacy Program, Phase 4. This is $1,730,000 for an agreement with the Redwood Area Development Corporation to acquire land in fee for management area purposes or for aquatic management area purposes. This is primarily in Renville and the surrounding counties on the Minnesota River. Line 4.26, accelerated prairie restorations and enhancement on DNR lands, Phase 4. This is $4.3 million for the Commissioner of Natural Resources to accelerate the restoration and enhancement of wildlife management areas, scientific and natural areas, and land under Native Prairie Bank easements. On page 5, line 5.3, the Anoka Sand Plain Habitat Restoration and Enhancement, Phase 2. This is $1,050,000 for an agreement to restore and enhance habitat on public lands in the Anoka Sand Plain and along the Rum River. It goes to a consortium of organizations as follows: $558,750 to Great River Greening, $99,400 to the Anoka Conservation District, $391,850 to the National Wild Turkey Federation. Each of those will be a contract between the recipient organization and the Department of Natural Resources with the Commissioner's approval. On 5.16, enhanced public grasslands, there's an appropriation for $1,320,000 for an agreement with Pheasants Forever in cooperation with the Minnesota Prairie Chicken Society to restore and enhance habitat on public lands for prairie chickens. That's the last of the prairie section appropriations. On page 5, line 5.27, is the beginning of the forest subdivision. We recommend $17.3 million to forests. On line 5.28 is the first forest appropriation, protecting Mississippi River Corridor Habitat, ACUB Partnership, Phase 2. This is $480,000 to the Board of Water and Soil Resources to acquire permanent conservation easements on land adjacent to the Mississippi River and the boundaries of the Minnesota National Guard Army Compatible Use Buffer. That's what ACUB is, Army Compatible Use Buffer. This is one of the major programs along with the Cannon River one that takes a watershed approach to habitat protection. On page 6, line 6.15 is the Mississippi Northwoods Habitat Complex Protection. This is our most visible project at $14,040,000 is for an agreement with Crow Wing County to acquire fee and land and fee along the Mississippi River in Crow Wing County to be added to the county forest system. This will be 2,000 acres, 2.7 miles of Mississippi River frontage northwest of the Brainerd Airport. Part of the Cuyuna Lake State Trail alignment crosses this land. Final amount paid will be determined by at least two DNR-directed and DNR-certified reviewed appraisals. These are grant rules for appraisals for land expecting to fetch over $10 million. This is an urban area project. You might not know it, but Crow Wing County has the population density to be a standard metropolitan statistical area. Excuse me. If you take the water surface out, and the federal regulations for determining an SMSA don't take into consideration the water and work against Crow Wing County and Brainerd in that respect.
Mr. Becker, yes. We have a question. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Becker, the annotated bill has a total, the appropriation total is the same, but then it has contracts listed for 485 and 15 to the DNR. But I don't see that language in the bill itself. How does that get passed through, or how does that get directed?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, the agreement with the Department of Natural Resources between Crow Wing County and the state will be for the full $14,040,000. Crow Wing County can expend the money for contracts. That happens to be contracts for enhancement in the accomplishment plan. The annotated bibliography should note that. If it doesn't, we'll correct it. And so as the Crow Wing County does enhancement of the property, they can pay the bills and get reimbursed by DNR under the main central contract. Enhancement would be fencing, clearing of brush, trash, things of that sort, plus making it suitable for public use through development of parking areas and things like that. Minimal development, but development nonetheless.
Follow up, Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, so I guess the contract is something that the DNR knows it's supposed to do, but it's not something that we're specifically appropriating money for. That seems to be the
Mr. Chair,
occasion. Becker.
Representative Winkler, I'm not clear on your question. We have elsewhere in the bill $175,000 for DNR to draw up contracts, and we'll get to that in the administration portion of it. This particular appropriation simply defines the amount of money that's to go to Crow Wing County, and its accompanying accomplishment plan directs how that money can be used or what they would be reimbursed for. I can get you the details on that if you want it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, that's not necessary. And I had a couple of just a follow-up question about this appraisal question, because I have information from the county on the county's appraised value, and they put the appraised value at something like $3.8 million for the same parcels. And I'm wondering where the 14 figure comes from, and because if Potlatch owns it, I understand. So the contract is between the DNR and the county. How does the county acquire it from the private landowner? How does that whole process work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, this may be an instance where we may want to call down the Trust for Public Land who submitted this proposal. But as I understand it, the Trust for Public Land did an appraisal of the property, and based on that appraisal, and they can come down and correct me if I'm wrong, based on that appraisal, entered into an option to purchase this land. And I'm not sure what the option says in terms of price, whether it's at the final appraised price or what. I just don't have that information. They then presented the opportunity to the council to fund it, and we provided them with enough money to fund it, to buy it. If their appraisal of $14 million were substantiated by the state's review and appraisal processes, if it comes out to be more, I won't make any comment, comes out to be more, they would not have enough money, and we would have to, somebody would have to come in and partner with us. If it turns out to be less, the remainder would cancel back to the state into the account. Would you like for me to ask the Trust for Public Land to come down?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Becker, I think that'd be helpful. And I do have our finance staff was able to talk to the county about their appraised value. And so it'd be, I think, helpful to hear how this works, because I'm confused about whose role is what exactly.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Becker.
Representative Winkler, I appreciate it. I don't want to be in the position of representing an NGO.
Okay, we're going to have the Trust for Public Lands come up. Welcome, and state your name for the record, and we'll, Representative Winkler, you can proceed with your question. Your name for the record, please, and who you represent.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Schmidt, and I'm State Director for the Trust for Public Land.
And I'm Becca Nash, Project Manager with the Trust for Public Land.
Okay, Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, I don't know which testifier is best able to testify to the question, but The county appraises this property at something like $3.8 million, and your appraisal comes in at $14 million. Mr. Becker said that there was an option purchased on the land. And so I'm just wondering how this transaction works. And this is similar to questions last year I had, because I'm new to this, which is, what is the role and the value that the NGO provides if we're giving money to DNR to buy the land? What's the additional role for the Trust for Public Lands, and how do the numbers come together, and how does that whole process work?
Ms. Schmidt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Winkler, again, my name is Susan Schmidt. Maybe I'll start, and then Becca Nash is the project manager, and I'll turn to her on a couple of additional questions, if that's okay. But the Trust for Public Land, we're a national nonprofit organization, and we work on conservation throughout America and throughout Minnesota. Representative Winkler, typically we're asked to get involved in protecting land or protecting landscapes. Perhaps one out of 50 times when the landowner is asking for our help, the community might be asking for our help, or the agency who will own, potentially might own land in the long term, or neighbors might ask for our help. So one out of 50 times, for example, when land is protected, we're asked to be involved to, if you will, lead, coordinate, and facilitate the objectives of the different parties. So getting to yes, if you will, in conservation. In all those cases, we're working with the landowner, the community, and whoever will own the land in the long term. In this particular case, it's now the county. So let me use that as a background. That's why we get involved. We are asked by the community, the neighbors, the landowner, the agency. In this case, originally it was thought about as state ownership. Now it's county ownership, and we'd be glad to talk about that. I think I'll turn to Becca to just describe maybe how we enter into an option with the landowner in this particular case, and then maybe secondarily we'll address the question of assessed market value versus appraised fair market value.
Thank you again. My name is Becca Nash. And just as an example of this project.
Welcome, Ms. Nash.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The land in question has been a high priority for protection going back at least 10 years when we were originally involved in working with the county and the Department of Natural Resources, understanding that the landowner Potlatch Corporation was going to be selling off a number of their properties. And so we were working with the county and the DNR to take a look at the properties that Potlatch owned and to help figure out what would be priorities for protection so that we knew where to target our efforts, and so that every time land was sold, we didn't go through a, sort of emergency process. So we wanted to be proactive and identify. This land came up as being high priority for protection because of its habitat, because of its river frontage, because of the location of a potential state trail corridor through the property. So it was a convergence of a number of interests, including the forestry values, that made this a high priority for protection. Just as an example of how the Trust for Public Land works, the company came to us a little over a year ago now, to say that they had been looking at this property and doing substantial analysis and developing development proposals, plans for the property. And they told us at that time that they were going to proceed with development. The Trust for Public Land was able to act quickly, and that's usually when we're called in to help, is when there's a need to act quickly when land is threatened at being converted. And so we were able to act quickly and do some investigation in terms of the value of the property and get site control of the property to allow us the time to work with legislators, to work with the agencies, to work with the community to figure out a plan to protect the property. We knew it was a high priority, but we knew that if we didn't step forward and get site control, that this land was a threatened to being lost. So we, as part of our work, do some of the initial valuation investigation. We do get site control. We do all the due diligence that's required in order for the land to eventually be transferred into public ownership, including doing title work, environmental assessments, survey work, and we do share that, all of that work, do it to the standards of the public agencies who will be acquiring the land and share that work with them for free. So hopefully that gives a little overview of what our role is, and then specifically with regard to the appraisal and the tax assessed value, if there are any questions on what I've said so far.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Nash, just to be clear, so when you say site control, you're saying that's when you purchase the option.
Correct.
To purchase.
Mr. Chair, correct.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Nash, typically an option is a percentage of the total value of the property. And I assume that you will be passing the cost of the option onto the state, or maybe not, I don't know. But how do you determine what the value of the option is, and how to sort of move forward with that?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Winkler, are you asking the cost to secure the option, or are you talking the cost of the land?
Representative Winkler.
The cost of the option.
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, it's negotiable, and that is usually a cost that TPL incurs and takes the risk for both fronting up and losing, and it's negotiated.
Representative Winkler?
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Nash, presumably there's a timeline on here and a price. And so TPL is fronting the money for an option based on what you think you may be able to put together a deal with the state to come through with legacy funds and purchase the land at a certain price. So there must be, by a certain time. And otherwise the option expires and Potlatch could sell to someone else, or they could come back to the state and do it all over again. Is that, I don't know, but I would imagine that the option price motivates the level of funding that you're seeking. In other words, if you negotiate an option for to purchase the land for $12 million, you're not going to come to the state and say we want $5 million. You're going to say we want $12 million because that's what the option's for. And so you're saying yes, and I guess then the question is that information that you keep confidential, or is that shared, or what is the public role in understanding what the deal struck is at this point?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, that's a very good question. We have been very honest, I think, in explaining that the deal with the company has been a deal for fair market value of the property. And based on initial appraisal work, that number has come in at $14 million. Mind you, please, the appraisal process has not completed yet. We're still in the middle of an appraisal review process, but given the quick timing that was needed and the timing for getting our request in the LSARD Council and the timing that we've been given to successfully protect this land, we've had to come forward with the best information available at the time. So that number right now is $14 million, but please understand that there's still a process that has not completed yet.
Representative Winkler?
Mr. Chair, then that leads into the question of the appraised value versus the assessed value and the appraisal process, and I think ultimately the question of who pays for it and who does it. I wonder if you could just describe that further.
Ms. Nash?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, very good question about the appraisal versus the tax assessment. And I can tell you what I know, and there are other resources, I think, just to check with, but I can tell you initially what my understanding is, because in my experience and talking to a number of people in the field of real estate and appraisals and appraisers and tax assessors, it is not uncommon at all for there to be a difference between the tax assessed value of a property and the appraised value of the property, and for that matter the sale price of a property. A couple of the differences between a tax assessment and an appraisal. A tax assessor will look at a property using what's called a mass appraisal techniques. And they simply do not have the time and resources to conduct an appraisal on every single property in their jurisdiction. In fact, by law, they're only required to physically inspect a property once every 5 years. So as a result, a tax assessor is looking at generalities in land trends within their jurisdiction. An appraiser, by comparison, will do an in-depth study on the property, its unique features and limitations, and conduct a detailed analysis of the market demands on some of those features. A tax assessor will also look at the property's current use and classification, whereas an appraiser will look at this, but they'll also look at the property's highest and best use. That's an appraiser's job, is to determine the highest and best use, what is the maximum return that could be seen for this property. So for this property, the tax assessed value reflects its use as open vacant land. It's been forest land for over 100 years. So it's open vacant forested land. An appraised value would also look at development approach. This isn't something that a tax assessment is going to reflect, but an appraiser will look at the development potential of the property. They'll collect data from the marketplace on the demand, on the cost associated, if there's a development proposal, on the cost associated with a development proposal, and conduct pricing and a much deeper analysis of that potential land use. An assessor might also look at a property on a 40-acre parcel basis or a tax parcel basis rather than the entire property. So, for example, this property contains 51 different tax parcels, and each of those tax parcels are assessed individually. And so the tax assessed value is the sum of all the individual tax parcel assessments. So an appraiser is obviously going to look at the whole property. What can you do with the whole property? What are the features that are on the whole property? An example of how this might play out is if you have waterfront on a piece of property, the value of that waterfront may only be reflected in the tax parcel that has the actual waterfront on it, whereas an appraiser might look at the whole property and see this whole property has access to the waterfront, and therefore that value should be spread out over the whole property more. And then one more difference that I'm aware of is that a tax assessor is looking at valuing lands within his or her jurisdiction. So a tax assessor, in this case, would be looking within Crow Wing County to look at other 40s or like-sized tax parcels in the area. And that's not always an accurate reflection of the demand in the marketplace. So an appraiser has more flexibility and can actually look outside and say, the people who are buying these kinds of properties are also buying lands in X, Y, and Z communities, and so they can go out and look at, for example, where can you find another 2,000-acre property on a major natural resource like this, because I don't think that there are any other in Crow Wing County. So that's my knowledge. It's limited knowledge, but I know that the Department of Revenue has a number of fact sheets on their website that do describe this, and I think that they would be a good resource, as well as the DNR, and maybe the Department of Transportation, who also does quite a bit of land acquisition and appraisal work, and they might have more perspective on that question.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Nash.
Well, we need to move along, so if you could hit your main questions here, please.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. This is the highlight of the bill, we're told, and it's $14 million, and we have information that says the tax assessed value is $3.8 million. I think that's a legitimate set of questions. Thank you. And so, Ms. Nash, everything you say, I think is true and I agree with, but there still seems to be a large difference. I mean, it's a quick calculation shows the county assesses it at $2,000 or $2,100 an acre, and this is at the full $14 million, which would divide up anyway. It's about $7,500 an acre, so it's more than three times the value of the assessed property. So that leads to me the question of what is the process, if you could describe that, for determining the fair market value going forward. I understand that on an initial basis you have to move quickly, et cetera, but what's the process going forward for determining the fair market value that will be paid, and who's conducting that? I understand there are standards, but how does it practically work?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler, an appraisal, we have done an initial appraisal. A second appraisal will be done, and the appraisal is done by a professional appraiser, independent, not us as staff. I'm not an appraiser. It's somebody we hire out for, the DNR hires out for, county hires out for. And the appraisal is conducted according to uniform standard for professional appraisal practices. It's kind of the Bible of the appraisal world. And it's conducted according to specific DNR standards, and they have materials up on their website that, that explain what those standards are and as required by law. So the first appraisal has been conducted. A second appraisal will be conducted as well. Then what happens is that at this point, the DNR will be responsible for hiring a third appraiser to look at both appraisals, make sure that each appraiser has followed all of those rules and guidelines, do quality control checking, checking facts, testing methods, and ensuring that the appraisals are done to these quality standards. That appraiser then will recommend to the DNR whether to certify the appraisal or not, and usually they're deciding between one of those two appraisals. And so that then becomes the certified fair market value of the property, and that presumably would then become the purchase price.
Thank you.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an expensive proposition, so one of the things I would like to put on the table is that when we're don't want the tax assessor's assessment to be minimized, because when we asked House Research to call the assessor offered that this parcel is actually between the city dump on one side and an airport on another side. So the city assessor was aware of that. The city assessor was also aware that hunting land was going for between $2,000 and $2,500 an acre, and that amount had been stable for quite some time. So I don't want us to in any way imply that this assessor didn't know what he was doing. But I have another line of questions. When I looked at the worksheet accomplishment plan for this, it said that there was $500,000 set aside for transaction costs, et cetera. And so I asked about that and was told that in testimony, you all testified that you were going to get 4% of the amount, the final amount, and that would be going to trust for public land. Did I hear that correctly?
Ms. Nash.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, just to clarify, the $500,000 that was in the grant request, that is for restoration and enhancement work on the property. And I think there were $15,000 that is, I believe, required that we request, and that is to cover DNR transaction costs. So that's their lands and minerals staff, their attorney general review. So there are no, none of the Trust for Public Lands transaction costs are included in the request.
Chair.
Well, if I could go forward and go ahead.
Well, Representative Wagenius, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Wagenius, to your point, Trust for Public Land has testified that they are being paid by Potlatch $500,000 to do this transaction. They've also acknowledged they got $540,000 to do LaSalle Lake. LaSalle Lake was done last year at $8.7 million. Their payment from Potlatch on this one will be $500,000. That might be, you might be confusing two different things there that happen to be $500,000 each.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm glad you clarified that. It doesn't make matters any better. It actually perhaps makes matters worse. So if there is a 4% expectation, it does seem to me that the higher this appraisal value is, the more money that you will receive from Potlatch. Is that correct?
Representative McNamara?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, I think they've got a flat fee situation. I don't think it is contingent on the more Potlatch pays, the more they get. They could correct me if I'm wrong.
Mr.
Schmidt?
Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee and Representative Wagenius, I'd be glad to answer that question and just be perfectly clear, as I have been with LaSalle and Chicago Board Heritage Council and other committees. Let me back up. The Trust for Public Land is a nonprofit organization, a 501c public charity with a mission of conserving land for the public. Whether it's a park or a trail in the heart of our cities or a more natural based place, such as the land up on the Mississippi River in question. We seek support from foundations, businesses, and individuals that believe in our mission, and we're happy to do that each and every day. And we also seek support from the landowners that we work with ourselves. We believe that it's critically important because it's not taxpayer dollars that we're seeking to support our work. It is private dollars that we are seeking to support our work. The support is very similar to a real estate broker in the private marketplace. In Minnesota, a fee of a landowner can be 7 to 10% of the purchase price, so we can come back to that question. That is typically what we would seek from a landowner to support our mission, our work, the cost of the project, etc. In this particular case, as I stated before, and I'll say it again, the fee is 4% of the purchase price that the landowner will pay us when conservation occurs. And let me just clarify that these costs cover the expenses of our charitable mission, so all the funds go into achieving our mission of, again, protecting land for the public to use and enjoy. Add to that? I'll stop there.
Representative Wagenius.
I understand that Potlatch is giving you the money, but in effect, it's taxpayer money because we're giving them $14 million. That's one thing. Everything else we do, or we're supposed to do, is on a reimbursement basis. So, and we don't, everything else. So this is different, and I question whether it is appropriate. Certainly, when Potlatch does it this way, they give you $500,000 or whatever, they then take it off on their taxes, I assume. I would have to ask our tax folks, but I assume that they consider it a charitable deduction and take it off of their taxes. It's a very nice gig, but I question its appropriateness for state taxpayers.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative
Schmidt.
I know Representative McNamara wants to jump in here too, but let me just add that a landowner has the ability and does pay for real estate brokers, they pay for lawyers, they pay for many services they secure in the process of any transaction or any of their work. And I would offer this is very similar to any other payment they
make. Representative McNamara, and then Representative Torpes.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say I don't know that we're going to be able to get through this project today in the discussion, and it might be helpful. The county is the future owner. I know we're coming back tomorrow, and I'm wondering if we should allow the potential for Commissioner TD to potentially come down tomorrow, or someone from the county that may want to answer some of the questions and talk a little bit about the project. I'm not sure who else. I know Representative Lilly's in the audience, and we're the two authors of the bill, and both of us have been to the property, and we could talk about this property a little bit more, about what it's like and what the characteristics are and what the drive is to secure this property. There has been a recent newspaper article on it. It is property that's situated above the dam in the Brainerd Lakes area. It's in the backwaters of the upper Mississippi. It's situated between the Brainerd Airport and the county landfill along Highway 210 on the east side of Brainerd. So folks can get some information on it, but it might be good, Mr. Chair. It is, I believe, the second biggest project, separate of things like RIM, that we've done in Lessard Sam. So it probably makes sense in and of itself that it's $14 million. So I just wanted to offer the opportunity, Mr. Chair, that we have a further discussion tomorrow on the project if members want.
Who were you suggesting, Representative McNamara, that we bring in?
Well, someone from the county, I'm thinking, Mr. Chair, could come down and be available for questions if people had specific questions of how this. It is kind of unique. The state's paying $14 million for the property and then going to let the county have it. And I don't know if we've ever done anything like that. So it might be interesting. DNR has said they would prefer to have the county own it than themselves. And so, and it seems like other people are on board with that, but I thought it might be good to discuss that point.
Okay, Representative McMurray, we'll talk to you further and arrange to do that.
Yes, and I believe Ms. Schmidt, Mr. Chair, could make the contact to the county.
All right, Ms. Schmidt, would you make that contact for us, please?
I'd be glad to.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson, and then Representative Wiggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is in relation to the timing of the appraisals. When will that information be made available? And I guess how that timing of that appraisal process is reflected in the work of the council also.
Ms. Nash?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, we are working to get a second appraisal as soon as possible. There are certain procedures that need to be followed before we can hire out the appraisal, and we are working through those issues with DNR right now. But please know it is of utmost importance to us that this is moving forward as quickly as possible. So I think that's the best answer I can give right now.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the first appraisal has been done, and that is in your hands and is held privately for some time.
Mr. Chair, I think generally speaking, the process is best handled by the appraisers and reviewers, and so it's not considered a final product until it has been reviewed and certified by the DNR. And so I think it is generally approved practices that they are not public until after that process has been complete.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. I guess then I would like Mr. Becker to come forward and just tell us how the appraisal process fits into Lessard Sam's timing on these issues.
Welcome back, Mr. Becker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson. In presenting the project to the council, the council asked whether there was an appraised price, and the answer was roughly in the affirmative. The council asked to see the appraisal, and we were convinced that the Data Practices Act and the Landowner Bill of Rights made it difficult for us to look at the appraisal as a council to distribute it. So the council looked into the processes that were used at DNR. We're pretty familiar with them, to make sure that if this appropriation were to go forward, then there would be a public official at the Department of Natural Resources who would certify the price to be paid. And we're convinced, especially after having seen their revised requirements, that as far as paying a fair price, the public interest was protected. But in no time did we assume that it would necessarily be $14 million. That was what was requested and put on the table to make the project happen. But it could have been a $10 million appraisal. Now that Representative Winkler has let us know that it was 3.5, I thought it was 4,100 an acre, but it could be $7 million, what have you.
Representative Parkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Becker, did the council have some comfort with that $14 million price tag? You know, by putting it in print, certainly it adds some validity to that. I don't know if we call it an estimate or what we call it at this point. It's not an official appraisal, but certainly the action of the council to me signifies that they at least felt that this price was appropriate. And at $7,000 an acre, I realize the price of farmland's gone up, but I don't think I can raise much corn up there.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Becker.
Representative Torkelson. It's hard to say what the council thought, but in my mind, the price has always been an issue.
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair and Representative Torkelson, I think the other thing is we compared the price of this land to the price that we paid for LaSalle Lake last year, and it's very similar. I think even less.
Thank you. Representative McNamara?
Well, I was just pointing at Representative Torkelson. I thought he was ready to make a comment.
Representative Torkelson is done.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to say,
Representative McNamara,
we need to be really careful if we're going to compare this property to Lake LaSalle.
Yeah.
Lake LaSalle does not have another house on the entire lake except for what we bought. It's 200 feet deep. It does not have any homes anywhere on the lake. We own the entire shoreline. The state does.
It's kind of like Greenleaf.
Very, very similar, Mr. Chair. But LaSalle Lake, we actually paid $10,000 an acre, and we paid, I believe, two times the tax assessed value, if I'm not mistaken, around that. So we paid substantially more than the tax assessed value. But it is a jewel that is completely different than anything this state, I believe, has ever bought or in a situation that's unique.
Thank you, Representative McNamara. Representative Wagenius, do you have a quick question?
Just a quick comment, Representative McNamara. I don't need anybody from Wayne County to say that this is a nice property and that we should own it. My question is the price we're paying and to have this different, well, this donation issue rather than reimbursement for costs that we do for everything else. So I have two questions, and it's not that I'm sure Crow Wing County would love to have this piece of property given to it by the state. That's not an issue. It's not an issue whether it's a nice piece of property. The question here is what the taxpayers are paying. And is it fair, and does we have a system that actually works to protect taxpayers as well as to protect land? And that's my concern.
Thank you, Representative Wagenius. I don't know if that question is rhetorical or not. If it isn't, Representative McNamara will pick that up tomorrow.
If I could continue the bill tomorrow.
Yes. We have some other commitments, and we actually have to get out of here a few minutes early today. So we will continue this tomorrow. And I guess that's what this case is closed. See you tomorrow.